Well, everybody, I just had to answer a call on the other line. This is Daniel from the House of Prayer, and this is 6:35. I usually give 5 minutes for everybody on a Thursday night call. This is allegedly known as the 12th day of May, 2022, so they say. And we came here to fellowship under the umbrella of God's good grace to meet in this ecclesiastical community. And we are. Can you hear me? Why don't we have everybody just go ahead and mute out their phone by hitting *6, if you wouldn't mind, so that we can get the background noise off. I'm kind of partial that myself and the guest speaker have an uninterrupted opportunity, and this enables me not to mute you out as well here, so I'll continue. *6 to mute out, please. Thank you so very, very much. So tonight we've got a couple of special guests with us tonight. We've got Dave Edwards, who we've been scheduled in the past to speak on the Private Membership Association, and we will allow him to have his opportunity to fully exhaust that subject. And we also have, after that, Danny Unger, who's going to share with us some information about his experience with the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, and he was the researcher with Al Barcroft, a primary researcher for Al Barcroft. So we're going to go ahead and get this ball rolling, let you all know what the House of Prayer call is. We have it every other Thursday night, the best we can. This has been a three-week duration here since the last House of Prayer call. Excuse me for my tongue tied there. We had a little vacation time. I did a presentation in Florida for some folks, and I had a little bit of a vacation time there. And I'm glad to be back here doing the House of Prayer call with you all. And just keep tuned. In 2 weeks, we're going to have another House of Prayer call. And I will give you a notification through email for that 26th of May so that you'll be aware of who our scheduled speaker is, which is undisclosed at this time. Just to let you know, we use the banner of Isaiah 58:6 for our purpose for gathering, which is identified in the book of Isaiah in the Holy Scriptures as the chosen fast. And the chosen fast is to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. And that's the purpose of our gathering here tonight, because God's people, as in times past, have suffered under the yoke of bondage and need to be set at liberty. So we are endeavoring to learn about the different ways and means to get relief from the boot on our neck. So on our call tonight, our first guest speaker is Dave Edwards, who had some health issues that we were praying for his speedy recovery, and we're so very thankful you're on, Dave. How's your sound check? How do you sound over there? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Dave Edwards, can you hear me? I don't know what happened. I just talked to him just a minute ago. Dave Edwards, can you hear me? All right. We've got ourselves a little bit of a problem here tonight, folks. I wonder what happened to Dave. Dave, if you're having problems with your phone, just call on back in, and I'll keep the ball rolling for a minute. I'm not sure what's going on, but we can't hear you. In the meanwhile, John, did you want to share what you've been doing with the friendly folks in Texas?
Well, I tell you what, it'd be better. We've had some really good luck on a few other things. Let's let Ed, if he'd kind of bring people up to some of the wins we've been having lately. Ed, could you chime in there? Hello, Ed. Well, anyway, he might be on a call or something. But
no, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, there you are, buddy. Yeah, I was just trying to get you to put a little information out there for the people about some of the good things that's been happening.
The wins?
Yes.
Well, you know me, John. I don't like to brag.
Yeah, that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I tell you what. With John's money issue letter and our child support cases and our Turner affidavit and now our notice of intent to file a claim and our revocation of power of attorneys and our GSA bond process, just to name a few, we are causing some fits out there in the legal community known as child support enforcement. And I had a guy call me today, and he said that he's in New York. He's got about $128,000 in arrears, and his children have been emancipated for at least 5 years. So the state's still trying to collect the money from him. He put all this stuff in that I just mentioned. And he called me up today, and he said, you know what, Ed? After months of not hearing from anybody, as soon as I put in that revocation of power of attorney and that GSA bond process you sent me, I got not one call but two from the state of New York, one from the clerk of the court or the financial administrator of the court and the family court, and one from the DHS acting secretary for the state of New York. And I said, well, what are they saying? And he said, all they both did was try to figure out where I got my information on these GSA bonds. So they're trying to figure out where that paperwork's coming from. And they wouldn't be doing that, folks, if they weren't worried about them. So the GSA bond process, that seems to be causing a big stir, because with the GSA bonds, we're also putting in a revocation of all powers of attorney, except by my hand, of all Social Security underwriting instruments. So that's the part that kills them right there. Revocation of powers of attorney of all Social Security underwriting instruments. So, it dawned on me about a month ago, you know what? Nobody can give or take away power of attorney except me. If I give someone a power of attorney or if I take it away, that's my decision and my decision alone. So what we're doing, the other thing we're doing differently with the paperwork we've been filing in the past and getting all these roadblocks is we're filing everything with the county recorder first. And then once it's filed on the land record with the county recorder's office, then we file it into the court case. And that's causing them a real big problem. So as far as specific cases go, I mean, we're everywhere right now, from Spain to England to California. I mean, we've from the West Coast to the East Coast, we've got international cases. We've actually got clients that are calling from the UK saying that child support's coming after them from, like, Hawaii or Colorado. So these guys, they're relentless, but so are we. And we think we're really close to shutting this down for a lot of people. So I'll keep everybody abreast of that. But with John's help and Chris Henry, he's just a master at what he does. He knows more about child support than any other man alive. I say that with all sincerity. But, of course, once we get done with this, it's not but a jump and a skip to go to Child Protective Services, or as we better know it, lucrative child care fostering programs and services for profit. So we will be in touch about that. But that's really all I got for this week. I'm sure I got a lot more, but I can't. My mind's blank. Did we get our main our guest speaker on? Did you get him?
Ed, did you hear about the guy that told the judge to pretty much stick it and walked out of court?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's in our latest 1983 claim. We're not coming back. But yeah, I've heard Chris tell stories too. We got a story down in South Georgia where the judge said, you're going to provide that financial. Are you going to provide your financial worksheet or not? And the guy said, well, that's up to you, Your Honor. And he said, well, what do you mean? And he said, Well, I can't provide it until you give me the subpoena. When will you be issuing the subpoena? And then they stop the case. So that's, it turns out that they have to have, by federal law, they have to have a subpoena because your financial information is considered private information and is protected under the Fourth and Fifth Amendment. So they can't get it without a subpoena, and since these are administrative courts, they can't issue a subpoena. So that's another thing that we've uncovered. If you're in child support, you have every right to a trial by jury, and that's another thing that they can't do. They can't call a jury. So these are the things that we're figuring out.
Did Chris tell you about the guy that went in and called them all contractors and told them they didn't have any judicial authority?
Yes. Yes, and I believe they got all real quiet at that time, and I think he also said, now, Your Honor, it's my understanding, because I think the judge was going to try to hold him in contempt. And he said, well, Your Honor, it's my understanding if you do that, you'll have to hold the whole court in contempt. And the judge said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, aren't I an officer of this court just like everybody else? And he said, you could have heard a pin drop. Because that's what you are, folks. By your birth certificate, you're a lifetime surety, but you're also a warranted contracting officer, which means you're another officer of the court. And, just to update everybody, I think most on here saw my You're Fired, Mr. Prosecutor letter for firing the prosecutor. I'm now working on one to fire the judge. So stay tuned for that, because I think that's going to be pretty hard to overcome as well. So I'm working on one right now to fire the judge. So I'm going to get rid of the judge and the prosecutor.
And, hey, Ed, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Do you have a pickup truck and carry one of those big sets of cowballs at the behind your trailer hitch?
I don't, man. I think that's kind of a redneckish thing, but it's funny to me. I laugh every time.
I think I need to send you one with the biggest cowballs I've ever seen. I'm just being honest with you. Don't forgive my sense of humor tonight, but Huh?
What you need to send him is a wheelbarrow.
Right now, what are you doing up there on that bench in that black dress? Get down! You've been fired. Go back to wherever you came from. Send me somebody judicial.
So you're dealing with administrative courts. So tell the folks here your understanding of, say they're not in a family court proceeding. You deal mostly in family court proceedings. So let's say you're brought into a traffic ticket. Let's say you're being brought into court on another matter. Would you talk about that?
All administrative and all magistrates. Not a judicial ounce of authority in the building. Any judge, and there's case law that says this, any judge that's enforcing a statute is nothing more than a mere administrator. So
yeah, he's the head of the agency for the proceeding at hand.
Right, and then I also found in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, I think it's 63B, but I'm going by memory on that, that says that you can only be heard by a magistrate with consent of both parties. They have to have your consent, so they presume it unless you bring it up on objection.
Yeah, that's the United States District Court magistrate judges, exactly. And there's a procedure.
All United States judges. All United States judges. But it is Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Correct. Yep, we've seen that too, Ed. You're an amazing fellow to have on our call. Of course, I'm buttering you up to keep you on our calls, Ed. I hope you realize that.
Sure, man. I come here whenever I can. I'm here.
I know.
You know, because I want to make sure. I'm doing some cutting edge stuff right now, and it's been the weirdest thing for the past month. I've had all these great ideas, and I've been trying to act on them, like with the passports and stuff. Let me give you an update on that. We got a letter. A good friend of mine in California, got a letter last week saying that using the 14th Amendment. So she sent the business process letter in, and they sent her back a form letter, and I know it's a form letter because now I've seen two of them. And they're almost verbatim the same letter. But what's weird about it is they both came from the San Francisco Passport Agency out of Sterling, Virginia. But both of these are residents of California. And with everybody else in the country that has filed that business process letter, they've got no word. For me, myself, as you know, I gave them 14 days to respond. I sent mine back on April the 12th, and it's been 30 days as of today. So I gave them 14 days to respond or stipulate that I'm sovereign, and I still don't have a response. So next time I walk into court, I'm also going to be telling the fire judge that I'm sovereign, and he has no jurisdiction over me, and that's coming from the U.S. Department of State Secretary of State.
So, you keep us informed about that.
Yeah, well
thank you.
I'm actually writing back to these form letters that they're sending about the 14th Amendment because I find it hilarious. Apparently, they're not. Apparently, the people at the State Department doesn't realize that there's two governments and there's two sets of citizens out there, one for each of those governments. So I'll have a fun day with writing those letters back, but I will upload that to you, Daniel, so you can see what the letter looks like after I redact it.
Is it something that you want me to share with the House of Prayer?
Yeah, because I want people to see what we're doing as we go through the process.
Now, this letter is the redacted process. What? Redacted? Is it redacted fire the judge you're talking about?
No, I'm going to redact the information of my client.
Which letter are you referring to? I keep a list of letters so that when I put the call on, I can include them. Which letter?
This is a rejection letter that a client received to the business process letter for the five-star passport.
Oh, I see. I got it. Got it. Thank you. Well, I guess we had a little bit of confusion with our guest speaker tonight. Thank you for filling in some of that weighty, heavy information at the beginning of the call, and thanks, John, for spurring that on. I believe that Dave is on the call, and we can go ahead and get our previously scheduled information rolling if you guys got it all out there that you wanted to share in the beginning. Okay. No, nothing else has to be said about what we just talked about. Dave, can I hear you now? We don't hear you, Dave. I just called them on the other line while you were talking, Ed, and there might be some problems with his microphone. I don't know. Have you muted yourself out, Dave? Now, he said he heard us talking, folks, so I'm confused as to what's going on here.
I can always talk chance. More about getting I can always talk more about getting rejected if y'all want to work it out.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave. I'm going to go ahead and jump off this line and call him and find out what's going on because he said he could hear us and he heard you talking. And I'm just going to figure out what's going on. If you wouldn't mind filling in for me as I go and give him a call, okay?
Sure. Just interrupt
thank
when you come
thank
back.
You, Ed. All yep, right. Thank you.
So anyway, I found it very highly unusual that both the rejection letters come from San Francisco by way of Sterling, Virginia, but none of the other places, including Hawaii, have responded to the business letter. So that gives you an idea about California. You know, they don't want anybody to be anything else other than a U.S. citizen out there. I know that for a fact now. But I'm on my third week of my passport application. I haven't received mine back yet, but if it comes back with anything less than five stars, I'm going to send them the UCC codes and the business process letter I sent them that went unanswered and see what they have to say about that. But I'm just I kind of wish they had sent me one of these rejection letters talking about the 14th Amendment, because apparently someone at the State Department, oh, that's another thing. The letter was signed by customer service. No name. No legal affairs counselor, law enforcement liaison, just customer service. So we have nobody to actually send the reply back to, but I happen to know about the acting director of legal affairs and law enforcement liaison, so I'll be sending the reply back to her with a copy of the rejection letter and say, hey, is somebody at the State Department trying to play a trick on me? But that should be really interesting, because the idea here, folks, is get a 5-star passport on the first try. That's what we're attempting to do here. Also, I don't know for those that don't know, but after I sent my passport, my business passport process letter, before I went to go into the post office to get a passport, the day that I went in, the section where I got the endorsement codes, they blocked the whole title. They changed the website on April the 19th, 2022, and that's the date I went in to apply for my passport. Luckily, I got PDF files of the code before they hit it. And then I'll tell you something else interesting that I noted. Unless you have, because when I did the PDF files, it also copied the actual web address on the page that I was on. So if I punch that, if I go to the block site now on the State Department's website, which is fam.state.gov, if I go to that website and I punch in, instead of going to that page, I punch in the whole code that I got from the original pages when they had it visible, it comes up. But there's no way for you to know what that website page address is unless you have a copy of it prior. But when you try to get in now, it's blocked. So
yeah, and
they blocked the whole section. Yes.
And for the listening audience, that's FAM is the Foreign Affairs Manual. And I just wanted to let you know, Ed, that we figured out the problems with why we couldn't hear Dave, and I believe he's on the call now. If you're done with your train of thought, or do you need to wrap up?
No, I am not. Dave, whatever Dave's got is much more interesting than what I've been doing. I want to hear what he has to say.
Well, Dave, how about now? Can we hear you, Dave?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can, Dave. Welcome to the House of Prayer Call on the 12th day of May, 2022, so they say. You are on. The floor is yours.
I'm not sure if it's more interesting or not, but sorry for being so late. I called in the wrong number, and apparently I was listening to last week's playback thinking that it was a live conversation, and I was waiting for a point to jump in when Daniel called me, and we figured out I was on the wrong call. So now I'm here. Hopefully we can get some good things accomplished.
Of course, you are welcome here, Dave, and we're thankful you're in good health, and we've been excited about listening and advertised your private membership association information. So do you want to have it to be a dialogue, or do you have something prepared that you wanted to go ahead and present as far as a foundation?
No, I can talk for a couple minutes, but it's usually more effective when it's a dialogue, because I've been doing this for so long that I forget that a lot of the things that I refer to aren't general knowledge anymore. So I kind of presume that with some of these things, people already know what I'm talking about. And that's when I get the deer in the headlights look. But everything that I've been teaching for the last few decades is all all used to be common knowledge. We're not taught these things anymore, and we're not taught them for a reason. But government's known for a very long time that they can change the mindset of an entire generation, an entire country just by changing what's taught in the schools or what's not taught in the public schools, and that's kind of where we come to. People have lost sight of or even an awareness of the difference between the public domain and the private domain, or your public business and your private business. The only reason we refer to them as the public domain and private domain is because that's the terminology the courts have always used. If you start tracing it back, the origins of that language goes back to the Constitution and the fact that certain things were delegated to government, and those are public domain activities. That everything else was reserved to the states and the people respectively. But we also need to keep in mind that when we start talking about constitutional issues, that most common thinking in today's society is that the Constitution applies to everybody and the people, and it doesn't. It never has. It was never intended to. The Constitution was an agreement between the states that created the national government. The relationship that you have with government is should be your state constitutions, and everybody seems to ignore the state constitutions. But there is a separation between public and private, and when we start talking about bringing our business and activities into the private domain, the vehicle to do that is your private membership association. Now, things still operated the way they were intended to be in this country, we wouldn't have to have that designation. It would be a lot easier to keep your private business private, but without creating the entity to do that. But it is what it is. So the means of doing that is by creating your own private membership association. You have God-given unalienable rights, even though government at all levels at most times don't want to keep that in mind or don't want you to be aware of it. You have a right to associate. The Supreme Court's always said that the right to assemble and the right to association are synonymous. Have a right to privacy, but you have a right to an unlimited right to contact and a right to private contract, and those are the biggest precepts to keeping your business private within the private domain. You're creating that membership association that's reliant upon your right to assemble or your right to associate and your right to privacy and your right to contract. There are some areas where the states have been have given authority in the public domain, and everything that wasn't given to them is still reserved to the people. When we start talking about the protection of our rights and the ability to exercise those rights, we've got to start looking at the history of some of the case law surrounding those. And one of my favorite cases from U.S. law history is Hale versus Hinkle from 1906. The Supreme Court didn't guard their wording near as much as what they do now. And within the text of that decision, the Supreme Court specifically says that I don't want to get into back into the discussion about citizenship, but the Supreme Court specifically says that no citizen owes any duty or obligation to the state or to his neighbor to disclose his private business. And there's a host of other cases that can be cited on guaranteeing your rights to privacy. But and then depending on what type of association you're talking about, there are other areas that you still have the ability to assert. Some of the states, for example, Colorado, last year tried to pass legislation that says that all homeschool children are now subject to vaccine requirements, and that the parents must have at least a minimum of a master's degree to teach their own children in a homeschool environment. But, well, it didn't pass, but I imagine they'll probably be trying that again at some point. But you have cases like Pierce versus the Society of Sisters and Meyer versus Nebraska and San Antonio Independent School District versus Rodriguez. But these are all cases where the rights of association and the rights to education are have been once again determined to be fundamental rights. So it's not a matter of that you don't have the rights, it's a matter of being yourself in a position to be able to assert them. If you're working within a properly established private membership association, then all of the business that's conducted within that association is going to be a private relationship. It's a private contractual matter. The biggest need for these protections in this country has always been focused around our natural and alternative health care providers. But most of the litigation that's taken place, it was most heavily litigated during the 50s and 60s, but and actually became a cornerstone rights movement in this country. At one point, the state of Alabama tried to order the NAACP to turn over their membership rosters to the state. And for obvious reasons, the NAACP didn't want their the state having access to their membership rosters. So by the time that case made its way to the Supreme Court told the state of Alabama, you guys need to take a step back here and learn to stay in your lane. You do not have the authority or the ability to demand the internal documents of a private organization. But now when we start talking about those kind of cases, the one of the most common questions I get is, or most common comment is, yeah, but that's from the 1960s. Do you have anything more recent showing the court's perspective hasn't changed? And most people, when I'm having these conversations, don't seem to realize that the older the case law is, that at least in most cases, the longer that case law stands, the more strength it's going to be given in its arguments. If you have to have that something more recently, then you can look at 2017 in New York. A group of Democrats got together and tried to sue DNC in federal court. They claimed that the DNC represented to Democrats across the country that they were going to endorse Bernie Sanders for president. And then after getting the support of Democrats across the country, they endorsed Hillary Clinton, but, which was contrary to what they had been promoting. And the transcripts of that case still say it's not justiciable. You're talking about the internal activities of a private organization, and it's not within the jurisdiction of the courts to get involved or even hear those matters. So the position of a private association and the authority within a private association have always been here. It's not a new concept. But we had private associations in place before this country was founded. But most people are familiar with the metaphor of the separation of church and state. In fact, most of the attorneys and elected leaders I talk to, for some reason, believe that's in the Constitution. But that metaphor itself comes from, at least the usage in this country, comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptists in 1802, shortly after Jefferson was elected president. But, and the Danbury Baptists were the Danbury Baptist Association. It was an association. They've always been here, but they've always had the ability to keep their private business private and under the jurisdiction of the regulation of government. But government has the authority under public law. They have the ability to regulate under public law. Now, there is a limit to the protections of the private domain, but they're pretty extreme. If you go back to Skank versus the U.S. from 1919, it they're very clear where those limits are set. But the state has the ability to get involved in your private business if you're engaging in an activity that creates a clear and present danger of a substantial evil or substantive evil. But so I used to tell people quite often, don't follow the lead of Jim Jones trying to get people to drink this grape Kool-Aid, and you're going to be fine. But learn what your rights are and how to assert those rights. As long as you're not, it doesn't say that the decision in that case doesn't say anything about a suspected danger of a substantial evil. It says a clear and present danger of a substantial evil. So anything less than that, the states are going to have a really hard time interfering with your business. But if your institution is founded properly, and you know what the rights are that you have. Part of the problem that we've been seeing over probably the last 10 years or so is that we're seeing far too many associations out here that are not properly founded. But the people that are founding these associations think they have protections that they really don't have, or they're going to have to really pay to invoke those protections. But all because their founding documents are not drafted properly. But we're taught that within contracts we're supposed to include a governance clause. But so just about every contract you've ever signed somewhere has a governance clause giving governance to the laws of the state of Texas or the laws of the state of Colorado or that statutory language. If your documents have that governance clause within your founding documents, you've already declared that your association is subject to law. You can't come later and claim that you're not subject to it if your founding documents have already declared it. That's just one example of statutory compliant language. So it's not that the people that are drafting these documents that are intentionally trying to scam people. And there are those out there that are just looking to make a quick buck and move on. But most of it because they haven't taken the time to learn what it is that needs to be in these founding documents for a properly established BMA, or more importantly, what needs to be left out of those documents. But I'm trying to take what would normally be a two-hour conversation and condense it into a more of an overview, at least until we get into a back-and-forth dialogue. But to try and bring the general information forward for everybody. But another side of what I've been doing for a long time is helping the churches to reorganize and get out of the structure of incorporation because a corporation is a creature of the state. But and we do the same things with the ministries and help people with the documentation that are founding their ministries. But the church leaders have been taught since the 1950s that they need to incorporate their churches to protect their pastors from liability, and they need to become 501c3 entities in order to offer tax-deductible status to their donors. What they're not taught is they already have those abilities, but, and they don't have to allow government intrusion in order to stand on those abilities. When you hear the when you're talking about the structure of the churches and you hear free state versus free church versus a state church, an incorporated church is a state church. An unincorporated church is a free church. But you cannot create a corporation on your own authority. You have to petition the Secretary of State to do it on your behalf. The state is the creator of every corporation out there. But they created on your behalf. There's a maxim of law that says the creator will always have the ability to govern the created, and the created can never be superior to the creator. So as long as you're making these entities incorporated entities, the state will always have the ability to regulate them. But now as long as you're following up with that and seeking 501c3 status, now not only are they subject to the states, now they become subject to federal government. In 1954, Lyndon Johnson was still a senator, and he's responsible for the Johnson Amendment. He had a couple of very large Christian organizations that were opposing his candidacy for office, but and that's what motivated him to bring forward the Johnson Amendment in the first place. The Johnson Amendment regulates the charities and the 501c3s. First off, 501c3 is a charity. You can call it a church, or you can call it a faith-based organization, or you can call it whatever you want to call it. That doesn't change the fact that 501c3 is a charity. But that's Title 26 of the USC, 501 C1A or C3. That's what the 501c3 is. It's a charity. But so as long as you're seeking that charitable status, you're now subject to the Johnson Amendment. The Johnson Amendment is what prohibits certain things from being discussed within the churches. There are certain things you can't preach about, you can't teach about, but activities you can't become involved with or engaged in, and they're mostly all surrounding politics. But that's where the federal government gets their ability to regulate the churches. Over the decades, it was very common to talk to church leaders and to have them tell me, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but the regulation that we have to put up with is really minimal, and we're better just to not make waves. It's better not to rock the boat. My assumption has always been that it's a good thing that Jesus didn't have that attitude, but because he wasn't afraid to make waves. But more to the point is that since this whole pandemic started in March of 2020, we've seen churches across the country that are being told they have to close down, they have to social distance, they have to hold services in their parking lots, they have to limit their services to people or 50 people depending on where they're at, and then that moved into mandates. And but so the same church leaders that were before were saying we can live with a certain amount of regulation are now coming back and trying to figure out how to restructure their churches to become unincorporated churches without losing all of their assets. So we put a lot of effort into working with churches as well, and to helping people to establish their own ministries if their activities are activities that are consistent with ministries. But so on the one side of what we're doing, but we're focusing on the PMAs and the private domain and helping people learn how to keep their activities, private activities. And then on the other side of what we're doing, we're helping them to found the ministries and to found incorporated churches or can restructure as unincorporated churches. So again, I'm trying to put a two-hour conversation into a short period of time. And I think I've covered most of the basic information, or at least enough to, for everybody to start generating the questions that they're going to need answered in their minds. And usually when I'm having these conversations, even if they're one-on-one conversations, we'll start with the general information, and then I'll tell them that the best approach is always just to open it up and put the ball back in your court and ask you, what are the questions or concerns that you have that you feel you need to learn that, in order to start exploring the benefit of the private domain and whether or not that, choosing this structure is going to be helpful to you or to your lifestyle or to your business. But so that's pretty much the way I had hoped things were going to go here tonight, was that I could just kind of throw the general information out there and then rely on the questions and answers. Because if you've got questions or need clarification on anything that I can help with, somebody else on the call has probably got the same question in the back of their mind, even if they haven't realized it yet. So I want to make sure that the biggest part of our time together is devoted to that time to answer those questions. However that dialogue comes forth, if it's just a question and answer period, or if somebody in anticipation of me being here already has questions that they've written out and are prepared with those, that if you'd been planning for that already, I have to apologize for delaying this for a few more weeks. I was supposed to be here with you guys a few weeks ago, but we had some pretty bad things come up, and I wasn't able to be here. But hopefully, we can make up for that tonight. But I don't want anybody that's on this call or anybody that's listening to the playback, I don't want you to get the impression that I'm some kind of guru. But it just drives me nuts when I listen to these guys that want to be internet gurus. But this is an area that I'm considered an expert in, but almost all times I have more answers than more legitimate answers than just about anybody that you're going to talk to. But that doesn't mean I know it all. If I ever get to the point where I claim to know it all, then that's the point where you guys should just be hitting that button and not listening to me anymore, because I've been in law for 37 years, and I've been doing this specifically since 94 95, and I've got a pretty good handle on the information that I've been teaching for all these years, but I still learn things every day. I still study law and case law every day. I'm still finding new areas that are providing more clarification on things that may not have been that clear at some point in the past. So, anyway, if you haven't noticed, but I can very easily get to where I'm long-winded. If you give me the opportunity to talk, I'm going to take it. But and I'll just
It's all right, Dave. I'm going to give you a little bit of interaction here as the moderator, and then I'm going to open up to questions and comments from our House of Prayer audience. I just want to let you know, don't worry about being called or calling yourself a know-it-all, because on our calls, there are a few contenders. So anyway, I just got a couple things that came to mind during your presentation. You said there are areas where states have been given certain rights, everything else has been reserved to the people. So for the listening audience, would you like to give a few examples of the states' rights that have been granted, that the states have been given and the rest reserved to the people, so that the listening audience has an understanding of what you're referring to? We've got newbies, and we've got people here that's been doing it a long time, all inclusive in this call. So just give you an opportunity to bounce back, because you glazed right over that.
When I make that comment, I'm referring to what was delegated to the states within your state constitutions. Okay, there are certain powers that were delegated to the states, but because they were given specific duties and responsibilities, anything that was not delegated to them within that constitution is what we refer to as a retained power. Your state constitution, just like the federal constitution, your state constitution will spell out the fact that everything that's not delegated to your state is a power that's retained by the people. That's what we refer to as the retained powers jurisdiction, which is synonymous with the private domain. We have delegated powers that were granted to the state through that constitution, and we have retained powers, which are private domain powers. The state has to have, obviously, has to have rights, but there's no way for them to fulfill the duties that they're obligated to fulfill, but in accordance with that constitution, if they don't have the right to do it. That's the portion of sovereignty that was lent to the state by the people. Anything that wasn't delegated to them, any sovereignty that wasn't lent to the state is still retained by the people. Sometimes we need to remind them of it, but sometimes when we try and remind them of that, they still don't want to listen. We have to prepare for a fight sometimes. But that's what I'm referring to, is the rights of the state that are consistent with the duties that they were given. Now, every one of the states, the federal constitution, all of the state constitutions, that there are three specific areas that are their primary duties. That's to protect life, liberties, and property. Now, every state in this union has, to this point, has miserably failed at maintaining the obligations under the duty to protect our life, liberties, and property. But they haven't been that successful, especially when it comes to our liberties. But they still have a right to take whatever action needs to be taken in order to protect the life, liberties, and properties of the people of that state. Now, that in itself could lead into an entirely different conversation than what we're having here tonight, when you start talking about some of the decisions, the older decisions from the courts, where they've but you can see where they went back and forth through history. At times they made decisions siding with the people and the Constitution, and then other periods they would side with the states and issues of states' rights, and they made the determination that The state has the ability to diminish your rights in the interest of state rights, but as long as it's done so in a manner that's narrowly tailored. But personally, I believe the only reason they got away with it was because the proper arguments weren't made at the time. But to change that very dangerous mindset of the state justification of diminishing our rights. But that's what I'm talking about when I make those kind of comments, is the state has rights because they have duties that, and obligations that they were given when they were created, but in accordance with your state constitution. But and the wording that's contained within your state constitutions, but I've always encouraged everybody to go take a look at your state constitution, learn what's there and what's not there, because they're not all worded the same. They weren't all drafted by the same people. And as an example, here in Texas, our state constitution makes two declarations that have been there for the very first constitution that was put together when we separated from Mexico and became our own republic. But, and those assertions are, first, everything within the Texas Bill of Rights is forever inviolate. The second one is, everything within our Bill of Rights is accepted out of the powers of the government. Now, a lot of people don't understand the background of where those assertions came from, but it's all based upon the fact that the state doesn't get the ability to regulate your rights because the state didn't grant those rights, and the Constitution doesn't grant those rights. Those are God-given, unalienable rights. They existed before the state existed, and thankfully we have a Supreme Court that remembers. But seems like at all times, pretty much, they remember that our Constitution says that our rights are forever inviolate. But during this this COVID pandemic, our governor put out mandates that were worded in a manner that was going to take the responsibility off of him and put the responsibility for enforcement on our local and county governments. But so at that point, our Supreme Court didn't wait for somebody to start bringing cases for the Supreme Court to hear. They openly made an announcement that, to all of the local and county leaders, reminding them that our Constitution says that everything in our Bill of Rights is forever inviolate, and that they expect the local and county governments to keep that in mind. Because the state, any state of emergency issued, but a government does not in any way diminish or supersede the state constitution and our Bill of Rights. So I encourage everybody to read your state constitution first. Start learning what's in there. Learn how they're worded and the different the state constitution.
Yeah, Dave. Dave, you just broke up, and the difference, and you just, and you went blank.
Yes.
You went blank. I think you were saying in the different benefits therein.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I've got an example, yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Dave? Okay, I got an example that we want to address very specifically, because some of my friends that are listening now and the people that I've invited to the call and those that couldn't make it tonight but will be listening to the replay are very interested in being in private membership association with their congregational bodies. So let me give you an example that you might address with your years of experience in PMAs. So let's take, for example, a very controversial subject, such as a church's right to sacrament and use, say, certain plants that have been demonized by, say, governments. One state says yay, one state says nay. Maybe they want to participate in the use of that for, let's say, as the early 1900s, indica oil being the highest valued pharmaceutical, concerning the pharmaceutical journals, valued oil known to man at that time, and they desire to use that to for their health and well-being, but say the state might say that such is illegal. How does the private membership assist you, or is it just a pipe dream that such would be an exempt organization from such intrusion on our right to access a God-given plant?
Very controversial subject, I know, but I thought I would like at least bring it up to see how we go.
Yeah, because I've written documents for a couple of the ministries that are using that some of those natural resources. Even when they question the state and the state says, no, you can't do that. But some of the more recent case law and what's out there still surrounding the use of it in tribal settings and tribes of the Native American tribes. But there are a couple of those substances that have been, but there are now exceptions in written into federal law on the use of those, where they have to actually write those exceptions in order to remain compliant with the protections of religious liberties and freedoms. But some of the states still say, "No, we want to keep control over that." But there's it's becoming more and more a much easier case to defend than what it's been in the past. If we're talking about use within faith-based organizations, and that's one of the big differences between the two different structures I was talking about. But within a standard PMA, or a private association structure, you don't have the ability to invoke the protections of your religious liberties and freedoms. When we're founding the ministries or the unincorporated churches, that's where we get into the ability to invoke those protections as well. So if we're association is going to be engaging in the use of any of those plants, any of that plant material, anything that nature has provided to us, and that's the case where I'm going to strongly recommend that you're establishing a ministry instead of just a private association.
Can you repeat that, Dave, and expound?
Yeah, that's the point where I'm going to, when we're having that conversation, that's where I'm going to be recommending that you establish a faith organization or a ministry instead of just a standard association. You're going to have a much harder time with trying to justify your rights to keeping that out of governance with a standard association than you are justifying it as a faith-based argument and the protections of your religious liberties and freedoms.
Okay, so for the listening audience, you have, in your 37 years of experience, set up just basic private membership associations, and you've also set up an extension of that with a far greater, I imagine the governance clause would make the major difference if, amongst other things, where you're governed by, say, the scriptures and a higher law to identify your faith-based organization. Am I accurate?
Yes, that is accurate.
Okay. Earlier on, as I go on, and I'm sure the listening audience might fill in the gaps of when their questions come up that I might have left out. Early on, we broke up, and I believe you were saying Pierce versus
and in it's a society of blank. Was that the Society of Sisters you were referring to, that case?
Yes, Pierce versus the Society of Sisters.
Okay, yeah, it broke up, so that's fine. That's for the recording's sake. All right, now here's a big question. I don't know if you're prepared for this one, but I would think that it would be a possibility for us to wrap our head around. Could you potentially access a list, or could you provide a list on the listening call here about what are the necessary elements to be identified as a private membership association? If I was to sit down and say, we would like to establish a private membership association, not a faith-based organization, we just described the difference there, but just the elements
right.
that would consist of a private membership association, not in great deal. I wasn't actually asking you to read off some of your documentation, just the header, kind of give us
right.
an idea of the body.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. But before I do, give me just a minute here.
Not a problem. So I'll just fill in the gaps here by talking about the governance clause. For those of you that might be new on the House of Prayer calls that we have every 2 weeks as a matter of routine, and we do it fairly religiously, except when there's a break like there was last week. That happens very infrequently. I recommend that you go to myhouseshallbecalled.com to keep abreast of the identified times and dates of our scheduled calls and announce special guest speakers. And if you have, is this your first time on the call in a while, we have had some of the most dynamic calls. It's such a well-kept secret. I don't understand why, except for the fact that I don't make it my point to take our private calls and broadcast them all over social media. In some ways, I'm glad. In other ways, I'm saddened. But if you would like to catch some of the past recordings, you can go to myhouseshallbecalled.com, go to the tab, and if you're on a cell phone, you need to turn your cell phone sideways, and it's all the way to the right side of the phone. You won't access it if it's straight up and down. You got to turn it and rotate it. And it's a tab called Call Recordings. And there we have deposited some of the most phenomenal calls and documentations, such as some of Ed's information, John's, Dave's, and every once in a while I might come up with a good idea you might hear me say on these calls. I save most of my teaching time for when I go out like I did last week in Florida, but I do have a thing to say every once in a while. But you can go there and listen to some of our past calls, and I highly recommend that you do. Now, Dave, I filled some data.
Daniel.
Do you want me to continue?
Yeah. I apologize, but I guess I'm not as fully recovered as I thought. I keep every once in a while I get one of these out of nowhere, I get blindsided by some of these pains, and I had to alleviate those. So I apologize, but I'm back. So you're talking about the documentation for the PMA. When we're putting together founding documents, but even keeping them outside of statutory compliance, there are some other things that you need to keep in mind. When we do these, they come as a complete package. It's not just one simple agreement or a simple document. The documents that you're going to need are going to be determined by primary activities of the association. Is it a health association or an education association or a private social club? But the very minimum that has to be there in every one of those structures is you have a properly worded membership application. Within that application, there are a few key things that must be present. First, your members are acknowledging that they're voluntarily converting their capacity from a public person to a private member. you always have the ability to act in the capacity of a public person or a private person. And most of us will change that hat several times a day without even thinking about it. But when we go into the PMA environment, everybody must be very clear that this is private. But you're here in your private capacity, not your public capacity. And that's why that we see wording in the membership application that's similar to an assertion that we're not representing any government agency for the purposes of enforcement or entrapment. And actually, the reason we started putting that in there was because it's been probably 22 or 23 years ago now. One of my associations, several of the members within that association were judges, county sheriffs, local chiefs of police. But and one of the judges expressed a concern at one point, said that he was concerned that he might see or hear something within the association that his oath was going to require him to take back to his public office. So he wanted to see something in writing that asserted that he was there in his private capacity and not his public capacity. So we started including that in every membership application. But now it turns out the protections are bigger for us than it was for them anyway. But that's the reason why that assertion started going in there. So within your membership application, it has to be very clear that they're voluntarily joining the association, because there's no such thing as forced association, at least not legally. But and they must be voluntarily converting their capacity from a public person to a private member. But and they must be agreeing to keep all private business private, internal within the association. That includes any potential liabilities or any potential legal action if it falls short of clear and present danger of a substantial evil. If you become a member of one of my PMAs or even my ministry, but then you're going to see within my membership application and within my bylaw, but you're going to see a requirement to keep our private business private. Now, if you have some type of dispute resolution that needs to be settled, but it comes up internally, we have dispute resolution that needs to be settled between members, it's going to be settled internally. But that may be done through a dispute resolution committee, or it may be done through a tribunal provided by the association. You're entering into that private contractual obligation, so you're already obligated to follow the resolution that's provided within our own tribunals. But if you go into the public courts, they would refer to it as ADR, Alternative Dispute Resolution. But and when you have a civil case in the state courts, the judges are always trying to steer you toward, the judges and attorneys are always trying to steer you toward alternative dispute resolution, whether it's through mediation or arbitration or whatever means. But the civil cases are just overloading the dockets. But so for at least a couple of decades now, they've been pushing alternative dispute resolution that most available. In our association, we're providing that alternative resolution, and you're actually by contract prohibited from taking that business outside of association unless somebody has crossed that threshold of a clear and present danger of a substantive evil. we'll start talking about the power of the tribunals or the dispute resolution committees. But that's where a lot of people question, where do we get the authority to tell people they can't go to the public courts? Well, we get that authority through the contractual relationship been established and what they've agreed to, but upon becoming members. That private contract is powerful. I don't know what the average age of your listeners are. I'm going to presume that most of them are about the same age as we are. Most of them probably remember a TV show called The People's Court. People's Court cases were heard by a retired judge named Joseph Wapner. Judge Wapner was retired. He had no authority to sit on the bench or hear or decide any cases until those people entered into a private contract to have their disputes settled in that forum. At that point, whatever decision he makes is enforceable by any court because it's a matter of private contract. And that's the same environment you're setting up within your PMA. So those are the biggest things that must be addressed with your membership application, because there's no other part of founding documents that are going to be made public. But your bylaws, you'll need to make your bylaws available to your members. You can either provide everybody with a set of bylaws when they join, or you can do it upon request. But you have to make your bylaws available to your members.
Dave? You said when they join or upon, and it broke up. What did you say?
Or upon request.
Okay, thank you.
If they request a copy. Because your bylaws become your laws. If you're not governed by public law, they'll be governed by your bylaws. So you can't tell people they have to follow your rules and then not tell them what your rules are. So you have to make the bylaws available to them. And the Articles of Association, those are going to stay within the founders of the association. But those are the very basic things that that you're going to need as far as documentation to establish your PMA. They need to be outside of statutory compliance. You can't give government the authority to come in and regulate those activities for anything short of that threshold. And those are the three things that are going to be the basic needs of every package. But
would you also agree, Dave,
if you have a website for your PMA, that whatever's put on that is not necessarily considered making your business public. But you can put something on your website that says this information is intended for a member of the association. Now, it doesn't matter who views it. What matters is who it's intended for. So you're still keeping your business private. But even if you don't have a website that requires a login, the only thing that's public information that is your membership application, and any promotion of your association is always presumed to be for the purpose of recruiting new members anyway.
All right. Well, I just learned something good, and just for the listening audience sake, I've got to make a slight alteration to the House of Prayer website just because you've made a very good point there, Dave, and I do appreciate that. I wanted to say I didn't mean to interrupt you earlier. I thought I had a space to jump in and make it clear that if you're going to have a private membership association governed by private contract outside with an alternative dispute resolution, you don't want to give the state an interest or leg in your private association. And I'm just going to say this in the form of a question and leave myself up to be wrong for the listening audience sake to hear your complete point of view. But would you agree that you would not want to, quote, rely upon or use state statutes anywhere in your private membership contract to avoid giving the state an interest or a key or door in to your group?
As a general rule, yes, I would agree, absolutely. But there are cases where you can reference statutes. Now, not necessarily statute specific, just a reference to statutes that can still benefit you. You're not giving up governance of your association. For example, if your membership application declares that you're invoking protections under the Constitution, the various state constitutions, and statutes, you're not governance to those statutes. You're simply declaring that we have additional protections of our civil rights and our constitutionally guaranteed rights by statute as well. But now, if you get into using specific statutes and reliance on the identification of specific statutes, that's definitely not something I would recommend. Because I try and look at everything from the perspective of, but how would I look at this if I were the judge sitting on the bench and hearing this case that comes before me? But and if you start trying to quote statutes at that point, or the USC, in most cases, start tearing apart any protections that that you've claimed because you've given governance to the USC or to state statutes. So yeah, you definitely want to avoid them, but when you're putting together your fact documents.
Yeah, some would say private copywritten law is synonymous with state statutes. But the other thing I would say is, and we've said this on this call, Dave, from any calls that you might have missed in the past, we do understand and comprehend when a state statute which governs state activity protects or defines protection for an activity which you're attempting to preserve as defined therein. There is absolutely nothing wrong and everything right with binding them to their own rules. We comprehend that fully in this listening audience. At least the people that we've had on here would concur, the best of my knowledge. Anybody
great.
That doesn't, now's the time to speak up so I don't speak for you. But I want to open it up to the listening audience to ask you questions. I'm going to shut up. But I just want to say your alternative dispute resolution comment, which, by the way, I do think it needs to be in all of our private agreements and as to keep you out of the state courts. But I think in criminal law they call that a plea bargain. They take you over in sidebar and say, can you make a deal? And they do it in such a way that you don't realize you're actually agreeing to, in my opinion, an alternative dispute resolution. Right.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. But before we turn it over to the questions, as I said a couple of times, I'm trying to push a lot of information into a very short conversation. But I want to point out that I have a few different websites that can become good resources as well. You can find a lot of the explanations and a lot of the documents and a lot of the different case law with supporting everything that I've taught, case law going back to the early 1800s, but on your rights and rights to association. But I've had PMAPower.org, but probably my oldest existing site is PMAPower.org. There's a lot of documentation on there, but the newest of the sites is getyourpma.com. But a lot of that same information is on there, and you may find some additional information as well as some of the videos. Some of them are still on YouTube, but a lot of what we've had on YouTube in the past has been censored or taken down, so we're trying to stay away from relying on that YouTube platform. But there are videos there as well at pmapower.org and get your PMA. The ministry itself, I'm supposed to be retired, even now than I ever have in my life. But when I retired, I brought everything that I do under the umbrella of my ministry, and it's David versus Goliath Ministries. But so we still have. I was told there are problems today because I'm in the process of building a whole new site there, ministries.com, but as well. So if you come up,
can you repeat that? Can you repeat that?
David versus Goliath. Goliath.
Is that spelled? Ministries. Is that spelled out? Versus. You're just cutting out a little bit, Dave. No pressure. It's just cutting in and out over here. So it's David versus, all spelled out, V-E-R-S-E-S.
No, it's David vs. Goliath Ministries.com.
There you go. And I got a question before you turn it over to the listening audience, Dave. Funding with you here. My question relates to, I had recently had somebody ask about the efficacy of our call tonight, and they gave me a good question. Their question was, do you have any successes, or that you have any that's a conclusively evidence? One of the parties had asked on relation to private memberships and association, and it gave me a good opportunity. For this is what a lot of people like to hear, and rightly so. The scripture says, out of the mouth of two or three witnesses. Of course, we're hearing about you, about the two or three witnesses, but I'd love it if you would share some examples, some of the benefits, without having to mention any private membership associations, names, or business, that could encourage people of the efficacy of doing such a thing and how you've seen it benefit people.
Yeah, one of the things that we also have to realize is, but there are a lot of people out there that when they hear the word bar attorney, they cringe and automatically assume that all bar attorneys are your enemies. But I would strongly suggest that we start reconsidering that mindset. But because the uneducated bar attorneys that are going to be your enemies. There are, especially since this COVID thing started, there are a lot of attorneys out there practicing, licensed bar attorneys. I still take calls all the time, where they're telling me, for the first time in my career, I started studying the Constitution, and the system we have now isn't what it was supposed to be, and this isn't right, and we need to find a way to change things. So we do have bar attorneys in our network. They're drafting the same documents I draft. In fact, they use my documents as a template to draft documents for their own clients. And when the PMAs come under attack, they're the ones that are out there representing PMAs and fighting for the same rights that they normally would have been expected to be sanctioned for arguing the Constitution. But I've had, in the last couple of years, I've had attorneys going into courtrooms and taking their oath of this into the courtroom with them and telling these judges, my oath says that my first obligation to the Constitution and my second obligation is to the state Constitution and my third obligation is to the client. So we're not going to sit silently when you try and sanction us for arguing the Constitution. Going to stand on the minimum guarantee of rights that are within the Constitution and within the state Constitution. So keep that in mind. We have a lot of attorneys that are finally standing up and saying, "Hey, this system isn't right." So don't automatically discount all the bar attorneys either. But if you have the opportunity to join somebody else's PMA, if you think it's going to benefit you, whether it's a PMA or a private health association or a private education association, but you don't have to have membership dues for a PMA. That's entirely up to the administration of the PMA. But most of the ones I help put together don't have. So if you have an opportunity to join those PMAs, become a member. But because if they do come under attack for some reason, then it's going to be the membership that pulls them through that. But if somebody on the other side is trying to diminish your rights, that infringe upon those rights or completely deny those rights, you have recourse but, under civil law. Now, if you have a PMA that's being attacked, and that PMA is filing civil lawsuits, but they're taking the action that they feel is necessary to protect their rights and protect your rights. But if every individual member of that association is filing the same lawsuits, it changes the whole picture. If they're trying to diminish the rights of the association, they're trying to diminish the rights of the members. Qualified immunity does not extend to a violation of the guarantee of your rights. Qualified immunity and judicial immunity technically aren't law anyway. They're doctrines that were created by the courts, not legislation. But I can tell you absolutely, but if you've got some prosecutor out here that's trying to diminish your rights or some investigator that's working for some state agency and they get slapped with a civil rights lawsuit, but they're not going to be that concerned about it, but because they know that in most cases, the government entity is just going to settle it out of court anyway, and insurance will pay for it. If they're attacking an association that's got 400 members, and now all of a sudden they're facing 400 different lawsuits for infringing upon everybody's rights in that association, that changes the picture completely. If you've never been on either side of a lawsuit, but even when you know you're right and you know you're going to win, it's still a stressful situation. So just imagine how much pressure and anxiety it's going to add to every day of your life when you know you have to respond to 400 different lawsuits because you just attacked the wrong PMA. So especially if you're going to found your own PMA, get involved with everybody else's PMAs, even if it's not a real active involvement. Become a member, because if it happens to you, you're going to want other people around you that are going to be supportive of you, helping to protect your rights in the same way that you're going to be doing for them. If you let them get away with doing it to you, or let them get away with doing it to your neighbor, then eventually they're going to do it to you. But become a member of the PMAs. But if you have the ability to, become active on some level. But be willing to assert your rights as a member if you get attacked by an outside agency, but the same way you would if you were defending your own rights personally. But because there's still a lot more power collectively than individually, it's a lot easier to ignore one person than it is to ignore 400 people. So, I usually assert that into the conversation somewhere, and I just kind of realized that I had forgotten all about mentioning that portion of it, so I wanted to get that thrown in there before we go to the Q&A.
Okay, we were just going to ask about some specific testimonials, but I want to say for the folks that are listening that bulletproofsolutions.org and David Horowitz, which is become my good friend since we have met, and fellow minister and co-laborer, and myself, both participate and have private membership associations currently, And if that was a commercial for us, to be honest with you, that was not expected. But for the very first time, I can see where we can benefit, because I love what you said about the private membership standing there for the organization and bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ, where every joint supplies and the biblical principles that are laid out in the New Testament example of what I would say the private membership that was established when Jesus said, "My Father's house shall be called the house of prayer." And I understand that, and I teach, and if you go to my webpage, myhouseshallbecalled.com, I embrace the fact that I'm part of and a continuance in the oldest private membership association that I personally desire to be a part of, that which was established by Jesus of Nazareth and my kinsman and redeemer. So I want to put that out as a commercial, and this is a house of prayer call. That's how it was established, and you have just came in and unknowingly but so wonderfully gave us that, and we are a faith-based organization as well, reliance entirely upon the Holy Scriptures as the indenture. And Dave and I are working on some great Amen. Ways to bring this private membership association forward, and we're still working on something, but I hope that you, all the people in this call, would listen to the future calls. Before I set you up to talk to Dave with your personal questions, I want you to put it on your schedule to listen to these calls, because in my opinion, and I am boasting in a sense in the Lord here, because God has been very good to us. We've had good speakers, good information, good-hearted people that have been truly providing things, and we don't always agree, but truly providing things that have been able to be helpful, and we get testimonials of the same. And, you know, look at Ed over there kicking butt for the people in family court that otherwise would be a wage slave to these unconscionable alleged contractual obligations. And I said the word alleged. So, and I'm sure that Ed, with the way his mind works, probably heard a few things that you said in your presentation that got his gears moving anyway, the way he thinks. He's got such a good mind. I was thinking, Ed, in case you didn't catch it, when he talked about the private contractor participate in that court, and he was talking about on relation to his private membership. And I'm sure you're thinking about it when you talked earlier about firing the judge and all that you do when it comes to understanding the court as commercial organizations there to make a profit. And so anyway, I'm going to open up to questions and comments. Of course, you loud ones that have a good voice and loud voice would probably go first, but let's leave room for everybody to get their questions in to Dave. And please respect each other. I'm going to unmute the lines now, because I've had to mute plenty of the calls that were not muted. So if you're going to make noise, I'm going to repeat, I'm going to unmute the whole listening audience. And if you are currently making noise in the background, go ahead and mute yourself back. And so I'm getting ready to unmute if you have that reason. So I'm opening up the phone lines. Some of you I can't unmute. You must have muted yourself. So just so you know. Questions for Dave.
Hi, Dave. John.
Question, David.
I got a question for you.
Hey, John.
That was great. Really good. Thank you for that. My question is, when you talk about unincorporated churches, are you talking about 508C1As?
Yes. Sure. Absolutely.
You are. Okay. We're
very clear on the protections of the Religious Freedoms Restoration Act, which is where the 508C1A came into existence in the first place. The state has no business getting involved in my church, and it doesn't have any business trying to impose taxation on my church, and it doesn't have any business trying to tell me that 501c I have to be a 501c3 structure. I have the same protections codified as 508c1a.
Okay, but we do still need an EIN, correct?
Yes, and it's all a matter of checking the right blocks on the SS4. Because it's, One of the things that if you run into it, they make very clear was that it's an entirely different scenario that when you're checking the way you're filling out that SS4. But just simply getting an EIN can put you under the jurisdiction of government, but and regulation if you're not doing it properly. If you're filling out that SS4 properly, you're invoking those protections of 508C1A without making your entity subject to federal codes.
Okay. I just wanted to confirm because I did my 508C1A 5 years, five years ago. So now I need to double check the SS4 is what you're saying to me. Is there something in particular on the SS4 that you're referring to that needs to be checked?
Well, yeah, and it's actually only two blocks. It's very, very simple, but it's changed a little bit since we've had the ability to do these online instead of having to mail them in. But now we're to the point where, in order to protect those or invoke those protections of 508C1A, that you need to check the block that says you're giving EIN for banking purposes,
mm-hmm.
and under entity type, check church and church control position.
You broke up, Dave. Could you repeat that, please?
Yes, under the entity type, you want to make sure that you're checking church or church-controlled organization.
Okay. Thank you.
Now that used to default to 501c3 status, even if you didn't initiate the 501c3, it doesn't do that anymore. Now it automatically defaults to 508c1a protections.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. I can remember now they're doing something to hide all that as well, too. I remember when I formed mine like 5 years ago, whatever it was, it's really buried just like everything else. They're trying to bury that as well now, too, so you can't find out about it. I forget what they were doing, but it was how they answer you when you call, and they give you this whole line of baloney. And but anyway, yeah. Good. You just confirmed what I did.
Steve Nestor went a long way in explaining the difference when he retired from the IRS. And I'm really grateful that he published those articles that he did back then. Because even today, it helps me with explaining the difference in the structure.
Yeah. Can you say his name again, Steve? What?
What I'm trying to explain to people.
What's his name?
Steve Nestor.
Yeah.
Steve Nestor, Nestor.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you very much.
Okay. There was someone else that had jumped in earlier.
Yeah, question, David. Being that the church is scheduled or established as a 508C1A, what about the PMAs, the Private Membership Association? How would they be established?
There's with the PMAs, there's no one blanket rule like there is with the 508C1A. It's going to depend primarily on two things, on how your founding documents are put together and the functions and operations of the association. Some of them will operate the same as a sole proprietorship business. Some of them will operate as tax-exempt associations. And with the tax-exempt associations, most of those fall under 501A1. Now, you can have a tax-exempt association that operates under 501c3. I don't know anybody who would voluntarily do that. But most of the nonprofit associations are going to fall under section 501a1.
Did you say 501?
A1.
501A1?
Yes.
Thank you.
Lowercase or uppercase A, Dave, on that quotation?
Lowercase.
All right. Good questions, by the way.
Were you saying
are you,
that
are you
was
done?
A profit? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was opening it up, making sure that the previous caller had his question answered to his satisfaction to move on.
Yes. Thank you.
Fantastic. Okay.
Just a point of clarification, really quick question. Was it you were saying that it was a not-for-profit or a non-profit?
A non-profit association operating under Section 501A1.
I apologize for the redundancy, but you broke up as you were saying that. Did you say not-for-profit or non-profit?
Non-profit.
Thank you.
This is Mark with a question.
I apologize for all the breaking up. I think it's got to be on my end for some reason, but hopefully we can keep this signal consistent for the rest of this call.
Yeah, *6 to unmute yourself. There was someone else that had to jump in there.
Yeah, Mark.
I got one more question if no one's jumping in.
Dave, who said Mark?
Yeah, Mark did.
Yeah, well, Mark. Mark wants to talk. He's got the floor.
All right. So previously we were talking about not relying upon statutory code for any authority, and yet here we're talking all about the IRS code with the 508C1A, et cetera, et cetera. Why not just operate on the fact that churches are ordained by Jesus Christ himself and rely on that authority? And to heck with statutory references. That's what's confusing me.
Amen.
That's what we do. But we're talking about the statutory references, but only in relation to getting the EIN. If you're not using a private banking system like the Liberty Dollar Network, then you're going to have the ability to do banking on behalf of your church or on behalf of your ministry. And in order to open one of those accounts, you're going to have a Social Security number or an EIN. And that's the only reason we're talking about IRS codes.
So that supports your SS4.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was saying that supports your SS4 when you check off a church or church-related organization.
Yes.
Okay.
Great question.
All right. Thank you. Done.
Dave, you gave me an opportunity to let the House of Prayer members realize that I've entered into a relationship with the Liberty Dollar. And would you like to explain, as the House of Prayer here, how the House of Prayer could be benefited by people participating with that organizational structure? Can you do a little bit there?
Oh, sure. there have been a lot of big changes to that since I spoke with you last. But David vs. Goliath Ministries now has the responsibility of maintaining the Liberty Dollar Network across the eastern half of the state of Texas. That that includes the city of Houston, which is the fourth largest city in this country. So we've taken on a much, much bigger responsibility than I ever intended to do when we aligned ourselves with Liberty Dollar. For those of you that aren't familiar with the Liberty Dollar, it simply gives you the Liberty Dollar Financial Association is structured as a private membership association. It gives you the ability to trade in silver or Liberty Dollar instead of reliance upon Federal Reserve notes. But the Liberty Dollar first established back in 1998. that and was actually the inspiration for Bitcoin. But a relatively small number of people seem to know anything about the Liberty Dollar. But so they hear about it now, they think it's something new. But it just gives you the ability to trade in legally trade in silver within your the membership of the Liberty Dollar Financial Association. If you're trading in silver, you're not adding to the national debt when you spend U.S. dollars every day. But and it's there's access to a private currency. They call it private money, private people, but that's physically backed by silver. So I'm sure everybody here knows that our U.S. dollar is a fiat currency, and it's not backed by gold or silver like it used to be in the old days. It's reliant upon the full faith credit of the United States. So as long as they're willing to pay their bills and pay down the national debt, it holds at least a promise of value. But with the Liberty Dollar, every Liberty Dollar that's printed has a serial number on it, and that serial number is physically tied to silver that's stored in the secure facilities in Philadelphia. So every Liberty Dollar issued is physically backed by silver and redeemable for silver at any time. If you have a need to, I'm sorry, Daniel, before I go to the next comment, but did you create your account there yet?
Oh yeah, of course. That's why I was announcing this, because it was just to let the folks know it was my intent, and we talked about it foundationally before Dave had some personal matters that got in the way of our communication. It was my intention to be able to announce tonight one of those options that you had discussed with me, if you know what I'm referring to, about our local office here.
Yes. Yes. Anybody that's wanting to learn more about the Liberty Dollar or how to become a part of that association, but get with Daniel, and he can give you a referral link to bring you into the association. It's you have the ability to trade online instantly, making payments in silver or receiving payments in silver, just like you would with one of the services like PayPal. But you also have the ability to make this in U.S. dollars and have them deducted from your silver account balance. So if you're dealing with somebody that doesn't trade in silver, or that doesn't trade in silver, you can pay them in U.S. dollars and have it deducted from your silver account. There's no need for a Social Security number or an EIN, but within the Liberty Dollar Financial Association or the financial network. So some of the churches that we're helping to put together aren't even getting EINs anymore, open bank accounts. They're doing all of their private banking through the Liberty Dollar network. But there are a lot of benefits, but to each one of us individually. But business owners, there are a lot of benefits to business owners. There's an ability to keep your local economy strong, because you're keeping all of your wealth in your local economy, and you're not adding to the national debt. But when you're spending Liberty Dollars. Now, for the last, I keep saying at least 20 years, but I know it's been for at least the last 15 years, every money expert I've ever spoke with has very adamantly said the U.S. dollar is going to crash. We're past the point of no return. There's no stopping it. We just don't know when it's going to happen. And there's still a lot of people out there that say, no, it can never happen. The U.S. dollar could never crash. Well, if you think back to a year and a half ago, whatever source you were looking at online, whether it was social media or news outlets, you could see Venezuelan currency just floating down the street, just like trash, because it became worthless when it crashed. But so if you're thinking that the U.S. dollar can't crash, look at some of what's happened in the last couple of years, but in other countries. The same thing can happen here. But for the purposes of this conversation, let's assume that the U.S. dollar never crashes. You're still going to have inflation to deal with. The more inflation rises, the less the U.S. dollar is going to be worth. So if you're holding all of your assets in U.S. dollars, they're going to continue to devalue. But silver is a commodity. So if inflation goes up, the cost of silver goes up, and whatever silver is sitting in your account is now increased in value instead of decreased in value. But if you're accepting payments in silver, I'm not supposed to talk about taxes. I'm supposed to avoid tax conversations when it comes to silver. But back in 2014, I had a conversation with some people at the IRS Service Center in Springfield, Illinois. And they pulled one of the people from our legal department in to address some questions. But, and the result, we didn't intend to be discussing silver when I was in that conversation. That's just the direction it moved into. And they were very clear that silver cannot be taxed as an income. There's no income tax that can be applied to silver. So if you're earning an income in silver or getting paid in silver, but it's not creating a tax liability for an income tax, but it can be taxed as a I just lost my train of thought. Give me a minute and I'll as a capital gains, but you may be looking at a capital gains tax if you're holding silver. Any gains on the value in that over the course of the year, if you've held it for more than a year, but if you're buying your silver from the Liberty Dollar Financial Association, there's nothing in that association that's reported to the IRS anyway. So there's no way anybody's going to know that you've made capital gains unless you make that publicly available. But I'd strongly suggest to get with Daniel and get his link to the Liberty Dollar Financial Association and start looking and seeing what all's available to you in there, because there are other programs that that they've launched as well. They have the Liberty Dollar Store, but where you can trade with other vendors that are accepting Liberty Dollar payments if all of your local merchants aren't accepting Liberty Dollars or silver. But they're supposed to be going down the first of the week to sign paperwork on a very, very large warehouse. But because the administrator had aligned the Liberty Dollar Network with a couple of international exporters, they produce primarily food. Canned food, canned fruits, canned vegetables, and they're not able to distribute them across the U.S., but because they were declared to be for export only, but so now they're prohibited from distributing them in the U.S. It doesn't matter how many grocery store shelves might sit empty; by law, they cannot distribute them to suppliers in the U.S. Well, because it's a private association and a private arrangement, that they can distribute. The result is they've got millions and millions of cans of fruits and vegetables and other foods sitting on the shelves that they can't export now because but mostly because of what's come up out of this, the regulation from the COVID and the restrictions that that are still in place in a lot of the areas of the world. But the food isn't getting sent out. So they're sitting in warehouses waiting until the day that they can ship those foods. So they've aligned with the Liberty Dollar Network to allow the members to be able to buy directly from this warehouse. And any suppliers that are that have their own business, their own restaurants or whatever, that you can buy in bulk at bulk pricing cheaper than what Walmart or Sam's or Costco can buy it. But because these exporters are risking but so they're owning it at much cheaper rates. There are also opportunities still available. The warehouse is in South Carolina, and the Liberty Dollar in the Liberty Dollar Network, they have a website that's it was designed to be a social media network within the Liberty Dollar Network, and they also have an online store. Right now, it's only got about 3,000 different products in it, but all of these things are going to be available through the Liberty Dollar store as well. And it also gives you a place if you have a business and you want to sell, you can upload those to the Liberty Dollar store and people can buy from you in silver or Liberty Dollar, paper Liberty Dollars. The only drawback to trying to do business locally is you have to be in an area that's got a service center. But if you don't service
your
center,
phone went
the
out.
Only
you
way
have
you have
what?
You have to have a service center. If there's no local service center, the only way for you to redeem the private currency is by mailing it into the Liberty Dollars Financial Association to have it posted to your account. So they created a franchise program to give Liberty Dollar Network members the opportunity to bring a service center to your area, but at a very, very low franchise fee. But and then anything that's within that area and goes through your service center, you're going to have the ability to earn commissions off of every transaction within your city or town or your service center area. So if you're looking for this opportunity, then I strongly suggest you take a look at the franchise program as well. But even if you're not looking to start your own business, trading in the Liberty Dollar has a huge benefits. And there are some towns across the country where almost every business in town accepts Liberty Dollars in addition to Federal Reserve notes. But we don't have enough of them yet. We need business owners in every city, every county with, in this country accepting silver as a means of payment instead of relying only on Federal Reserve notes. Now, a couple of the things that I've done here in Texas is I went to the city council of one of the cities in this county, and I went to the county board of commissioners, and I told them, we can strengthen our local economy by keeping this wealth locally if everybody's trading in silver. If the city and county start trading in silver, then the business owners are going to follow suit. For them, it's just like making a decision to accept credit cards or PayPal. All they're doing is deciding to accept another means of payment. And that still didn't get the attention of the elected leaders too much, until I told them, right now, if you expect me to pay anything to the city, whether it's water bills or some kind of registration fees or taxes or court fines and costs. The only option you give me of doing that is trading with the U.S. dollar and adding to the national debt. If you can't provide me with an option to pay my taxes that's not going to add to the national debt, then we're going to end up in court at, overpaying taxes. And that's what actually got their attention. And they started realizing, wait a minute, everybody's paying taxes and adding to the national debt. So we need to start looking at ways.
You broke up, Dave.
They said we need to start looking at solutions of how to people can pay the city and county without U.S. dollar. That's what's got their attention.
Try one more time, Dave. We're getting a real bad connection. One more time. Be patient, folks.
Is this any better?
Yeah, go ahead and try it.
Okay. But their attention was told them they need to provide me means of paying taxes and costs and fees and fines without adding to the net debt. Not force me to pay those taxes if the only national debt.
Okay, you're really breaking up bad. I don't know if you can go into a different place, but it sounds pretty important. I liked what you're getting ready to say. In the meanwhile, if we're waiting for your bars and your signal to go up on your phone because of something that's blowing over, I want to tell folks that I've been in negotiation with Dave prior to our conversation about myself and potentially David in Montana having service centers to be able to help people within their endeavor for lawful money. So, of course, if you have any interest in this Liberty Dollar program that I personally have participated and joined, your first step is to contact me. And, of course, some of you may be wondering how to do that. And the best way to do that is through email at this time at imdanieljoseph@protonmail.com. imdanieljoseph@protonmail.com. So hopefully, Dave, your signal came back because you're getting ready to tell us about your communication with these municipal corporations and the benefits that they would have or your relationship on relation to their taxes, fees, and fines. It was wrapped up somewhere there, just to remind you where you left off.
Dave, this is Danny Unger.
Hold on a second. He's answering a question right now, please. He's taking his time in answering a question. We're having a hard time. I just asked him a question to finish his thought that he was losing because he was without a signal, folks. So be patient with me. You were talking about paying something in silver versus increasing the national debt, Dave. Can you finish that? Because it was breaking in and out.
Hey, Daniel, can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead. Do it now.
Okay, I got off the computer and on the cell phone, so hopefully this will help.
Oh, my goodness. Hi, Dave. First time tonight. You sound great. You're not a singer, are you? You got a wonderful phone voice now that we can hear you.
Oh. Yeah, the internet connection's been unstable, so.
Oh yeah, that was pretty unstable. You were on the subject of paying with your increasing the national debt by your payments and contributions. You want to finish that thought?
Yeah, I the city and county weren't real receptive to opening accounts in Liberty Dollars, but and first everybody that's on the city council claims to be Christian. So I and they're always very happy to tell people where they're going to church and how they're supporting the community. So I told them, you are not being good stewards with what you're given if you're holding all of the city's resources in Federal Reserve notes because it's too unstable. The second thing that I told them was, if you're requiring me to pay taxes or court costs and fines or the water bill or anything else in U.S. dollars, then you're requiring me to pay those things by adding to the national debt. And if you don't find a way to accept payment that's not going to add to the national debt, then we're going to end up in court over you accepting silver. And that was the one thing that seemed to get their attention, and it was as if they hadn't considered it before. And then they started discussing, wait a minute, we need to find a way to accept these payments without adding to the national debt. And what's being presented now is a way of doing that. But again, in order for them to accept Liberty Dollar, if they want to just accept silver payments, I can make those online instantly. But if they're going to take the paper Liberty Dollars, I have to have a service center here so they can deposit those Liberty Dollars into their service account or their silver account without having to do it through the mail. So these service centers are going to become a very important part of every community where they're being placed. But I also have church leaders from some of the bigger churches around the state that once they found out that bringing these service centers here is not a business investment for me, it's a community service activity of the ministry. Now they're wanting to align themselves with the ministry and start providing these service centers as community services for the people and the businesses in their own communities in the different areas of the state. But so getting these service centers in place is going to is going to be really helpful to everybody involved. But if you get your local elected, I don't want to call them elected leaders, I hate that term, but because they're not really my leaders. I guess maybe I'm getting into personal views now, but my elected representative, but they're a lot more of them are starting to realize that there are benefits to trading in silver, and they need to be supportive of these types of programs. And when they start supporting them, the businesses in your communities are going to start supporting them, and more of the businesses are going to start accepting silver as a form of payment and Liberty Dollars as a form of payment. But so it doesn't cost anything to join the association and open an account. You don't put one penny into it until you're ready to start buying silver. So I strongly recommend that everybody follow Daniel's link and get over there and get your account opened. But because silver went down, the cost of silver went down for like 4 days in a row, and it started going back up again yesterday. So if you have any intention of buying silver, get it while it's still a little bit cheaper before it starts getting back to where it was last week. But either way, get that account open. But so even if you're not putting any of your own Federal Reserve notes into it now, people have the ability to send you silver and start funding your account that way, but without tying up any of your own funds. If this crash does occur the way the experts are saying it's going to, but we're going to have far too many people across the country that are going to wake up one morning and find out that everything that's in their Federal Reserve account is now worthless. They don't have any way of supporting their families or paying their bills. I'll never be in that situation because I have a silver-backed currency. So if the U.S. currency becomes absolutely worthless, I can still pay my bills and support my family. The other side of that is, but if the U.S. dollar doesn't crash, like I said earlier, it's still going to be devalued as the as inflation rises. So I want the value of my silver increasing along with the rate of inflation. I want my silver worth more next week than it is this week. But, so I don't want to say don't listen to anything that I said tonight, but if you leave here tonight, leave this call tonight with nothing more than the alertness and awareness of the Liberty Dollar Network, then I still feel like I've accomplished a lot on this call. Like I said, it's not something new. It's been here since Bernard von Notenhaus developed the Liberty Dollar Financial in 1998. He spent 25 years working for a mint in Hawaii, and the last 20 of those years he spent studying money and local economies and the national economy and how they all tie together and the various means of being able to legally trade without counterfeiting. And he actually worked with people from the Treasury Department to make sure that what he was putting in place was appropriate. In 2004, he became a part of a broadcast that the Learning Channel did on money and how money works. And they brought him into that, and cameras followed him around for a little while, recording him trading with local merchants. And that put the Liberty Dollar Financial Association, or the Liberty Dollar Network, on the radar of the Department of Treasury. That's where Bernard got in trouble. When he first started printing the private currency, he had an equivalent on that currency of one U.S. dollar, five U.S. dollars, 10 U.S. dollars, and that constitutes counterfeiting. And the Department of Treasury became aware of that when they saw the Learning Channel's broadcast. So they went in, raided his facility, took all of the silver, all of the printed notes, all of the equipment, the presses, and they tried to charge him with counterfeiting and tried to get the judge to give him 22 years in federal prison. Well, the federal judge that heard this case said that the Treasury Department bears as much responsibility for this as he does, because he's been working with you guys for a few years trying to make sure he did this right, and you guys left that one vital piece of information away from him, which is the only reason he was printing notes that way. He said, I'm not going to put this man in prison when you guys made the mistake as well. He said, I'm ordering that the federal government return the 16 tons of silver that you took from his facilities, and I'm going to put him on probation for 1 year and give him the opportunity to change what he prints on the face of this private money. So now when you get Liberty dollars, it doesn't say that it's equivalent to $10 or $20. It shows the equivalent in denominations of ounces of silver. You can get them in 1/20th of an ounce, 1/10th of an ounce, 1/4 ounce, 1/2 ounce, 1 ounce, 5 ounces. And that was what set the precedent in the court systems. But when the federal court judge told the Treasury Department that you guys are as much responsible for this as he is, and then following that is when the guy that developed Bitcoin used the Liberty Dollar Network as his inspiration for Bitcoin. It's secure. It's not new. It's been here for a long time. People just aren't aware of it. And now more and more people are becoming aware of it. And I'm bringing the first service centers to the state of Texas. But believe it or not, we have absolutely no service centers anywhere in Texas. But I'm changing that with my ministry and the ministry activities. So I strongly recommend that everybody, if nothing else, go look at, follow Daniel's link and go look at the website. and take a look at what all's available to you, because I can absolutely guarantee you, you'll be glad that you did.
Well, there you go. I want to say a couple things before I open it back up, Dave. First of all, that was really clear, and I do appreciate you grabbing your cell phone. And, of course, I hope you have it away from your ear and all of that, as we all been instructed. So I've just got a couple things to say. Your municipal corporations that couldn't see the value of silver obviously haven't read our one of our fellows, John's, letters, I guess, his notice of circumstance or any having to do with the money. I mean, they might get a real appreciation on the other side of the coin, every pun intended. But I do have a couple of things to say. I did ask you, because I know that some of the listening audience would kick themselves for not asking this question. I want to make it clear that I asked Dave about the organizational structure, being able to take third-party checks, and he said, no, that is not a capability at this time. And has that changed, Dave?
No, that right there is literally the only reason I keep a Federal Reserve account for the ministry. But because the banking regulations that are now prohibiting them from depositing third-party checks unless they have a designation as a check-cashing center. But, and that designation puts them into a different taxing ability, and that's why they're going to continue to do that, because they get to collect more taxes. Other than that, the banking regulations that are laid out, and they're prohibiting the banks from accepting the deposit of third-party checks. So that's the reason Liberty Dollars cannot accept third-party checks. But
is there a way, and this is just me twisting things around in my head, maybe I'm being stupid, but they said there's no stupid questions. Can members direct their employers somehow to pay their paychecks payable to the Liberty Dollars, and how would this work?
In that case, those paychecks could be the same way they're direct deposited into a Federal Reserve account. It's all done over ACH, and Liberty Dollars can accept ACH. So those paychecks, if they chose to, can be deposited into their Liberty Dollar silver accounts. But
are you telling me that somebody that is engaged in a relationship, that they're an employee, can actually ultimately get paid in silver?
Yes.
You see, do you hear that, folks? I mean,
as long as your employer is willing to set up that account so they can transfer the funds, you can get paid in silver.
How would that work? This would be, don't they already have accounts where they do electronic filing in most corporations anyway?
Most of the corporations do, yes. But,
right. So if you're employed by a corporate entity, they more than likely have an ability to do electronic fund transfers, right?
Yes. And even the small businesses and the sole proprietorships, you can set up your payroll the same way. To do it all electronic transfers, and it'll transfer everything ACH to the Liberty Dollars account that you designate. There's still a need to be able to trade in U.S. currency. But for example, I can't pay the utility bills for the ministry in silver. They don't accept silver, or at least yet. Give me time to work on them. But the electric company will not take payment in silver. So I can log into my Liberty Dollars account, go to my bill payment page, and put in the information, who the check's payable to, the amount, the account number it's supposed to be credited to. They write the check in U.S. dollars, send it to the electric company, and they deduct it from my silver balance. Now, they're putting a debit card program in place that will pay out in U.S. dollars and deduct it from your silver balance. So if I go to one of the big corporations like Kroger or Walmart, any of the other businesses, when I get ready to check out, all I got to do is grab my cell phone, open the app, and transfer silver instantly from my account to theirs, and it's paid. But those that aren't accepting silver, but I'll be able to pay them with this debit card, and it'll deduct from my my silver account. Right now, Chime is one of the prepaid debit cards that you can transfer funds via ACH. So if I wanted to use the Chime card now, I could load funds out of my silver account onto the Chime card. But here very shortly, we're going to have our own debit card within this network. So you can still make those payments in U.S. dollars for anybody that's accepting a Visa or MasterCard and have it deducted from your silver accounts.
Yeah, this is such a good story. That's why I loved it when I heard it the first time. I love it now. Many of you that know me, I've been outside of the banking world since about 1988, and don't participate with the Social Security Administration personally, and haven't made enough quarters to worry about them being a parents patria to me when I get old. I'm not condemning anybody that does receive what they put into that private Social Security trust. I'm just saying that this is good news for me, the way I have been. My last question, and this is kind of a funny one, and I'm going to be really surprised how you answer. I'm sitting here anticipating. Will you all take a credit card payment to buy some Liberty dollars?
Yes, you can do that. You can do an e-check. You can do a credit card payment. You can do it through PayPal. You can do it through ACH.
Now, wait a minute. You mean to tell me I can max out my fiat currency credit right before the crash and spoil Egypt and buy silver?
Buy
I didn't
silver
say that on this call, but I'm just saying hypothetically speaking.
Buy silver with it. If I know the crash is coming, I'm going to max out my credit card the day before.
Well, no man knows the hour nor the day, folks, but you heard here on the House of Prayer call, you got some good ideas. All right, I'm going to shut up and let someone else ask questions, Dave. I want to let you know that our caller, our second guest, folks, I'm sorry for the advertisement, but Danny said he had to go, and now that we have gone on to almost 2.5 hours or so, I did remember that he was not a late nighter. And so he did request, Dave, he's in Texas, he did request that I share his email with you and so that you can know who he is. He was the researcher that worked with a primary researcher for Al Barcroft by his confessions. And so he wanted me to pass that on. And in fairness to him, because he had to leave, folks, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm not actually sorry. One of our House of Prayers keeps reminding me that I'm really not sorry. But I do regret that Danny Unger will not be speaking tonight. So at this point in time, you were the star player of the show. So and you did a fantastic job. I'm excited. We heard a lot of exciting things tonight. I think you really did a good job putting down the private membership associations and then the extra protections for those that understand their obligations, duties, and their responsibilities and privileges and immunities from the ecclesiastical side with the faith based organization that you spoke of.
When you
folks,
when
this
you
is your chance to
him,
do
when
what?
You speak with him, if you would extend my apologies for being so long-winded and cutting into his time. But
well, I hope he hears that, and I will do that.
I'm looking forward to the question and answer period, but I'm going to have to caution you. I'm starting to get to the point. Some of the things that these the doctors warned me about a couple of weeks ago, I'm starting to feel. So if I start getting too short of breath, I'm gonna have to jump off and go lay down.
Yeah, I get it. It's all right. Let's just see if there's anybody that has a question that hasn't been answered. That it's just on the it's an urgent thing. And we'll just move on to the final chapter of our call. Can we do that, Dave, for your sake? It's 9 o'clock anyway. I usually stop it. Huh?
Let's definitely definitely get that opportunity out there. I realize that even though I feel good most of the time, for those that don't know, I just had another heart attack a few weeks ago. So even though I feel good most of the time, my body's not fully recovered yet. So when I start to feeling like this, it's pretty important that I go lay down and give my body a chance to recover. But I want to be here for a while to help everybody that I have the ability to help. So I need to pay attention to my health so that I am here for a while.
So. Yep.
You better have a real good question, folks, after hearing that. You better have a real good question. All right, anybody else with a question? No pressure.
I have a question.
Go for it.
I have a question. So this is concerning the Secure Party Creditor process. I filed a Secure Party Creditor process, and I'm trying to get child support to take the lien off of some land that I bought. Is there any way that I can file an UCC-3, move everything into that, and would that make them take the lien off by filing a UCC-3?
I appreciate the question, but I tell you what, at this point in the venture, so I can catch your attention again, we are directing the question specifically to the subject matter of Dave with an urgent question, and then we will move on to any other questions that might happen. So if you could just be patient, and we can address your question after we let Dave get his answers that are directed directly to the subject matter of his talk, and then we'll move on. Is that okay?
I don't want to avoid
okay, I'm sorry.
Questions for anybody. But I do want to point out that when we start talking about the secured party creditor, there's nothing there that I've ever had any success with. So if you've got questions around that process, but there are areas that are my areas of expertise, and that's not one of them. So in good conscience, the only thing I could do is refer you to somebody that's more knowledgeable than I am about that.
It's okay. When we go and answer the question on that on the House of Prayer call, we've got plenty to address here as far as inspiration on that subject. But anybody else for Dave specifically to the subject matter so we can let him go and take his well-deserved rest that is itching and hasn't been answered?
I got one more, DJ. It deals with, we talked about 501c3, 508c1a's. Dave, it's been my understanding that Title 26 has never been enacted into positive law to this day, and that the enforcement provisions don't take effect until 3 days after it is enacted into positive law. What do you know about that?
Yes. Now, let me preface this by saying, if it's not a question that's directed toward a 508C1A entity, I don't normally get into detail about discussing taxes anymore. I used to, but I quit doing that about 6 or 7 years ago because my belief is if I can't give you the most current and accurate information, I'd rather not give you any. And I just literally don't have time to keep up with all the changes in the tax laws anymore. But specifically addressing your question, but I believe it's, although it's not been enacted, I believe it's going to be left more to the interpretation of the courts. And if you put yourself in that jurisdiction, the administrative courts of the tax commissioner's courts and their interpretations of it. And I think you might have a really tough time trying to stand on that argument when public perception is that it is law.
I wanted to ask it because a few years ago I went and looked myself, and it still wasn't a few years ago. And so I was wondering if there's been any change that you know of. So
not that I know of, but I still think it might be a tough. I'm not saying you can't make the argument successfully, but I think it might be a tough argument to stand on, given the limited knowledge of the judges that are on the bench today.
Yep. Yep.
Well, that'd be a good research project. That'd be a good research project for somebody that has too much time on their hands to go find out the multitude of cases that have attempted to raise an argument and what actually has been the decisions of the courts. And
right, because if you do find out that there's changes and it has been enacted, then by all means, let us all know. Because that's
absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, folks, for specific questions to Dave.
What is the website for the Liberty Dollar and the Liberty Dollar financing opportunity that you were talking about to become a franchisee and so forth?
Go ahead and got a link send me an email.
Daniel's got a link that he can provide for you that'll take you directly to all of that information on that site through his account.
Yeah, Dave, and these people may need to be understanding that Liberty Dollar Association is a private membership association. This whole thing is operating on the very construct that you shared tonight. I thought that would be very helpful for people to understand.
Actually, I had a conversation with the administrator today. They're wanting to, because of the way they operate, and the claims that they've made on their faith-based protections from the very beginning, they're wanting to restructure to bring the entire association under the umbrella of a ministry. But and there are a lot of various reasons for that. So they're still operating as a PMA, but here within the next 30 days or so, they're going to be transitioning. The PMA will become a project of the ministry. So
that's
you
beautiful
are,
news.
You are dealing with somebody that practices what they preach. It's
that's
not
beautiful
a
news,
just,
Dave.
So there's a lot of things happening that are very exciting, and it's if you're not already a part of that network, now's the perfect time to do it because of what's coming in the near and distant future.
And we can buy food too. I just wanted to say that many of us are concerned what we put in our pie holes. Do they have organic food to offer here in these? That's beautiful. Yeah. Folks, I don't know what you can do with a call like that. If you don't act, then I don't know. I mean, maybe you got to get the accent in your ears.
If you've been paying attention to when you go into the grocery store and you're seeing videos, either YouTube or Facebook, and even some of the mainstream media, you're seeing them talk about some of the shortages, including canned baby formula. You walk into the grocery store, and those shelves are sitting empty. They can't get it. There are reasons why these things are being controlled, but those are some of the specific areas where the Liberty Dollar Network has negotiated with these suppliers to reclassify some of that, but so that it's not subject only to public commerce, and we can now get it even when the stores can't. But
all right.
Of that's going to be provided through the Liberty Dollar stores.
That's beautiful. So I want to let the folks know, and I want to say it here for a public record, that this is the first time that I was made aware of this. Obviously, with Dave's health and my trip to Florida, we haven't connected for, I don't know, maybe a week and a half. And this is the first time I've been aware of this. So, Dave, I'm going to say this in the public forum, that we need to talk, I mean, ASAP, because as a private membership association, I would like our private membership association members, our faith-based organization members, to be able to access a drop shipment of a sea container filled. So this company that has been trying to get out their products, I'm talking about a drop ship of sea containers to our different community outposts and places for food. Because one of the things I do recognize, folks, and I've said it on this call before,
There are aliens. I believe in aliens. They're aliens to the house of God. The scripture says we were one time aliens to the Commonwealth of Israel. I have no doubt believing and seeing with my very eyes the fact that there are aliens out there that operate contrary to the perfect law of liberty. It's not hard to recognize that around you. So as such, it's our responsibility, nay, even our duty and obligation to our God and our people to provide for our family. For he that does not provide for his own is worse than an infidel. And we now the scripture says that the prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. So we have these scriptural references that talk about how we apply wisdom when we observe the times and the seasons around us. So, Dave, you've inspired me, and I don't know if such is a possibility, but if you can look into the drop shipment of sea containers filled with food, I can get orders. So there it is.
Those scriptural references are exactly what motivated the administration of the LDFA to start getting involved in the what most of the groups are calling food sovereignty and the control of access to food to people across the country. That was their biggest motivation for getting involved, was their reliance on scripture. And the only thing that's holding them up from taking delivery right now is they're waiting to sign a lease at the first of the week on a new warehouse that's capable of housing this large of a quantity of food. The suppliers have told Wayne is the administrator for the Liberty Dollar Financial Association, and they told him we can have a dozen 40-foot containers at your door within 24 hours. And if that's not enough, then you just let us know how much food you need, and we can have it all to you within 24 hours notice. So if we need to start diverting some of those containers in the form of a drop ship to some of these other areas, then that's definitely something Wayne's going to be interested in.
You better believe it. And I also wanted to let you know, and we can talk about this privately, that one of my friends, and he's a member of the body as well, has spoken to me in the past, and I've mentioned it on previous calls quite a long time ago, private and public in nature, about the development of a peer-to-peer network where it's not Craigslist, it's not Angie's List or any of these server-based organizations, but a peer-to-peer network between members. And I highly recommend that we all have a powwow, you, your administrator, me, and him, about what we have placed in play with some plans. We've been in the planning stage and discussing stage.
That peer-to-peer network is exactly what we've got in place now. And
you do have it already.
Yes. That's something people for a long time, and it's taken a while to get it in place, but it's there now.
We're talking about an app that you can put on your phone that you can reach out and trade amongst members privately?
Yep.
I love you, man. Yep. I don't have to do it now. I thought that I had to do this thing. Maybe I'll.
That's why he created the online storefront for the Liberty Dollars Financial Store, but he also wanted to duplicate a lot of the people that are on Etsy that are selling whatever goods they're creating. He wanted to give them the ability to upload their own products as well, but in addition to whatever the Liberty Dollar Network secures for everybody. And the platform's up and operational, but now.
But that's phenomenal. That is absolutely phenomenal. Of course, in the organizational structure of what I had a brainchild, the only difference was is that no bloodshed that occurred in the creation of the wealth between our members. It was a real purist idea where no Federal Reserve notes, credit money, war money, blood money would participate, would be completely separate and amongst the peers, and no blood was shed in the creation of our transactions. But we have to start somewhere. And if you got a peer-to-peer society, folks, I want you to understand what that means. That means you don't have to worry about your transaction going through a Facebook, a Twitter, a Craigslist, or an Angie's List. It's a peer-to-peer. It means you have direct access to the members amongst yourselves. Very phenomenal new program. If you've never heard about that type of technology, it is the way for our private ecclesiastical members to stay in contact with one another, absent these servers and, of course, the you might call it the intellectual property slavery that they would construe upon you with their extension of parents' patriae over your internet activity.
So the Liberty Liberty Dollar Network online is that was the primary goal of getting that in place in the first place. It's everybody uses it like an alternative to Facebook or other social media, but it's all peer to peer between the members of the Liberty Dollar Financial Network. And then the second phase of implementing that was getting the online store presence, but so that you have the ability to access all of these things without reliance on Federal Reserve notes. You can trade amongst your silver to silver or trade with the association silver to silver. And that there's been a lot of work over the years that's went into this. And here recently, the servers were down for almost a full day, but because the servers are based in the Netherlands. The reason for that is the court systems over there have always held that U.S. law and court and orders from U.S. courts are of no effect in the Netherlands. If they want to get access to anything that's on your servers, but they have to go through the courts in the Netherlands to be able to access what's on the servers. And the courts have said that you can't simply do that by making a request and making allegations that you believe there's activity that justifies it. You must go into one of their courts of law and prove that there's criminal activity before you can get access to what's on the servers in the Netherlands. And that's why they moved everything to those servers in the Netherlands.
Nice.
Wow. Folks, I want to let you know that, I became a member and participated and then went out to Florida. So I'm learning new things with you tonight, too, about my decision. I knew enough back when I participated. So
the more we talk, the more you can see why I'm getting more and more excited about about what's been done, and the people just don't know what's available to them now.
Yeah, I've learned a few things tonight that I didn't know, Dave, and I know there are some new things that happened since we spoke. But man, I'm so glad for the decision I made. And if I sound like I'm trying to encourage you to do something, I am, folks. This is phenomenal. So
amen.
We've got an opportunity. We can't sit there and whine about the economy if we've been given an alternative and don't take advantage of it. He said they would take credit cards and purchase silver. And I mean, a payment for a credit card, paying it back, even then at the price that the dollar might just pummel and fall, your payments to your silver is always going to have more value than fiat currency. I mean, I don't know how else to explain it. If you don't understand that, you might need to go back and take a course in intrinsic values versus fiat currency, and then maybe look.
I want to
say
one more thing before I get off of here, but actually two more things. But first, I want to thank everybody for being on the call and giving me the opportunity to share this information with you. But I really appreciate the opportunity. The second thing, I want to mention, again, this goes back to the Liberty Dollar Network, and the only reason I'm mentioning this is because it seems to become more and more important to people all the time. But within that Liberty Dollar account, they have the capability of all of the members creating what they call TD accounts, their term deposit accounts. It would be similar to taking advantage of a CD at a Federal Reserve Bank. But the accounts are terms of 6 months, 1 year, or 2 years. And you're going to earn an interest compounded monthly, but depending on which term you choose, but on your silver. So if you intend to keep something in a savings account and not spending it, then look at the term deposit accounts. That's becoming very popular. And again, it wasn't something I expected, but people are that in the past have given given their children at birthdays and Christmas, they give them U.S. savings bonds. Now they're giving them. Now they're giving their children silver instead of U.S. savings bonds, and they're creating these term deposit accounts for themselves and for their children to accumulate that interest according to whichever term you're. So it is a, with the exception of accepting third-party checks, it is a full-service private banking center that you have access to online and offline. So, but when you're looking around that site, take the time to look at all of the tabs and what's available. And we got one of my I have a network of PMA advisors, people that I've trained to teach other people. And one of them has started creating a series of videos for the Liberty Dollar, and his tutorials and training videos are online in the tutorials section. It shows you the functionality of what you can do within your accounts. So definitely take the time to look around while you're there, but before you make a decision, and see what all is available to you, and then go look at the Liberty Network as well, the social site and the store, and make sure that you're making an informed decision, because even with everything that I've covered, I think you're still going to be surprised at what all is available to you. There's so much hard work that's went into this over the last 20 years. And I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I didn't even know it existed until last year.
Dave, I want to say you're appreciated tonight. And I want to let our listening audience know that I've really made it a point to stop at 9 as much as I can, and I've stretched it to 9:27. I'm going to go ahead and stop the call as the moderator in the interest of your health and with grace to you, and tell everybody that if you haven't got your question answered, to please write it down and send it to me to IamDanielJoseph@protonmail.com. And I will direct it to our listening audience, the people that are on our call that have the ability to answer the questions if I'm unable to answer it myself. And I talked to Danny Unger by text and told him he's invited back next week. And if you folks were waiting on there, 2 weeks from now, actually, I'm sorry for saying next week, next call, it'll be on the 26th of May. And I want to thank everyone for participating in the House of Prayer call. And I'm going to just push this right over to God bless you. Y'all bless you. Have a great night. Thank you so much, Dave. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Great call, Dave.
You are more than welcome. Be blessed, everybody.